We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined once again by my colleague, Christopher Bedford, senior editor at the Federalist, also a co-founder over at RightForge. Christopher, thank you for joining us.
Lucky you.
I know. Well, if it's Thursday, it's Meet the Bedford. So Chris has a piece in the Federalist this morning with the title J.D. Vance and the New Right are racking up wins while the establishment stabs at their backs. Both clauses in that headline are important. We have not yet discussed Vance's win on the podcast yet. He was, of course, on the podcast before he formally announced last summer. You interviewed him and along with Ben, and that interview, reflecting on it now, I think was telling of how the campaign would play out. But Chris, start with the first clause in your headline. J.D. Vance and the New Right are racking up wins. What do you mean by that?
It's been a great month. I mean, it's been a great 30 days. May's been surprisingly good, too. There's a activist right that's more radical, that's breaking with the norms of how conservatives are supposed to act, you know, not being the polite conservative who just acquiesces. And they've been successful in the last few weeks. They've been pushing for, obviously, Ron DeSantis is a great example of this in the fight against Florida that says you no longer get perks. You no longer get corporate carve outs from our state if you use your corporate power to target parents and children. We've seen that in the potential for the Supreme Court to actively actually move and overturn Roe v. Wade and Casey, which would be phenomenal, lifting an awful burden off this country in a way that Bret Stephens of the New York Times, the supposedly conservative columnist, thinks is dangerous and imprudent and not conservative to remove that law. You've seen that with J.D. Vance winning out despite being someone who said, who's been open and says, I don't really care what happens in Ukraine. I care what happens in our border. I don't really, I want to go after the university systems and destroy them. I don't want to send them billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. All these different ideas that he's been pushing that just stand in stark contrast to Washington, D.C. There, you see that in the RNC pulling out of the debate commission and disrupting that, something that's supposed to be just an institution. And they're saying, you know what, we're not going to do the presidential debate commission anymore, which is the final legacy of Christopher Wallace. Mm-hmm. I hope his last time on TV would be, if his legacy is just destroying that commission, then it'll be great. But every single one of these moves gets pushback from the more frightened and timid and polite right, the establishment. I call them establishmentarians
in this. Call them complicit.
They're complicit. Yeah. They are, to use what's stand.
They actually support Disney. They actually support, right? Like, if you go on down the line, they might not support every sort of facet of Disney's position on the queer agenda.
Yeah.
But they
I may not
support
you abusing my kids, but I'll fight like hell for you to do it. It's like, what are you talking about? Yeah. They're completely insane. And they are what Stan Evans called. He's the founder of founder of Young Americans for Freedom, author of the Sharon Statement, a great conservative, passed away a few years ago.
Founder of NJC.
Founder of NJC. He wrote in 1961 that these people are silent partners.
Okay, so stop right there, because Chris includes this essay from The New Guard, which was the original publication of Young Americans for Freedom, a very influential magazine in the 60s and on, during the sort of build up into the Reagan Revolution and beyond. Chris actually revived the magazine when he was just a young boy.
So I got my start in writing.
Yes, 10 plus years ago.
Tending bar at night and breaking into the old computer lab, which we still had, to work on The New Guard during the day.
So I wanted to ask you actually to specifically break down the Stan Evans essay, give us the context, and tell us what Stan wrote about here and what his argument was.
So this is from the original issue of The New Guard, September 1961.
Wow.
And it stuck out to me because we'd selected it for the 50th anniversary and gotten our former chairman, Michael Jones, to write an introduction to it. We'd gone through all the articles and found maybe our 15 favorite and most poignant pieces from decades of New Guard magazines. And the title of this was, Can a Conservative Be a Radical? And it's because the Young Americans of Freedom were out there doing things that other people weren't. The You know, the left would go around with coffins and carrying them and hold these mock funeral processions that are extremely vivid and get in your heart and weird you out about what was going on in Vietnam, or right. what was going on with the Cold War. They were very much in favor of the agitprop and that kind of theater that grabbed people, the playing on the emotions. And there was a lot of conservatives back then who would get mad at young Americans for freedom to doing activism, for putting up crosses over abortion victims, mm-hmm. or putting up crosses for the victims of communism. They're going out there and getting in people's faces or spreading out throughout. They had tactics like they would spread out a diamond formation across college student council meetings, so it seemed like there were more of them there. Because they employed the Saul Alinsky tactics, the left-wing tactics, to push a right-wing agenda. And they were attacked for that and said that these aren't conservative. The conservatives is a attitude, or it's a characteristic. It's a process, or conservatism is a state of mind, not... And it was being destroyed by these tactics.
And this is in the context of Goldwater's ascent, too. I think it's mm-hmm. worth mentioning.
Very much. Yeah. Someone who really wanted to change what was going on in this country and do a radical reversal on it. And Stan pushed back, and I think completely correctly. He said that while there's certainly a conservative mindset that exists and something that lends itself more to conservatism, that tranquility, that peace, that kind of stuff that you might see Roger Scruton talk a lot about, the late philosopher, that's not the essence of it. The essence of it is truth and tradition and understanding of man and the world and society that we come from. And that we are at a point right now where the institutions, and he was at a point then too, we've seen the 50 years of it, the institutions, whether it's the colleges or the entertainment industry, now we have major league sports. A lot of the different courts were especially bad back then. Big business is particularly bad right now. Silicon Valley, when all of these institutions of these conservatives usually want to protect have become co-opted by the left, mm-hmm. and they become houses of just permanent left-wing revolution, then you don't want to be a process person. You don't want to be an institutionalist. These processes have now turned on you. The way that conservatives should defend slow-moving traditional process is if it's part of institutions that put up our society, prop it up, defend the true, defend tradition. You don't defend the slow advance of the left on destroying your entire way of life, on attacking truths, on saying that babies should no longer be sacrificed with federal. Okay, the seal of approval that men are men and women are women. If your institutions are all attacking you, then those institutions aren't worth defending. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of people out there, DeSantis, J.D. Vance, Tucker Carlson, who have irked so many of these process conservatives, these fake conservatives, because they want to actually fight the battles. They want to go after these institutions. They want to push back. They want to do battle in the halls of power with these left-wing champions. And that makes people uncomfortable, but it's essential. Donald Trump obviously was a leader in doing this and just bringing that fight out there publicly. And people didn't like to see it. They didn't like to see anyone on the right. Like, how dare we stoop to their level? So what are you talking about, stoop to their level? They're in our trenches. Are we going to defend the civilization or not?
Yeah, and stoop to their level is kind of an interesting way to put it. I think we lose sight of how quickly the sort of fundamental system has changed since, you know, the sort of foundations of the country have been attacked and have lost their potency, have lost trust, have lost sort of a consensus position. And I'm curious as to why, as you were mulling Vance's victory in particular this week, which we should add, there were pundits who were saying, you know, Trump is about to get a slap in the face because J.D. Vance is probably not going to win. Trump, of course, endorsed J.D. Vance fairly late in the game. Karl Rove actually wrote a column in the Wall Street
Journal.
He's saying this is not I think he said, quote, big win for Trump. Vance's victory is not a, quote, big win for Donald Trump. But he concedes in the piece that Trump's endorsement of Vance gave him the critical boost over his opponents. And Rove also argues that it drove voters to third candidate in the race away from Mandel, split the vote up a little bit more to allow Vance to run away with the plurality. Either way, he concedes that Trump was the critical.
He's missing the story because he's just a chirping secretary. Well, he's just a tally marker.
He's missing the story because to accept the story would be to concede major points to Donald Trump.
Donald Trump is not an historically good endorser.
Like, 100%.
He makes mistakes all the time. He's never been very great at endorsing. I think this was a great endorsement personally. But Karl Rove is just looking at this for the sake of Donald Trump's endorsement power, then he's looking at a game of chess like it's a game of checkers, which is completely unsurprising given Karl Rove's entire personality and career. But the J.D. Vance is a huge victory for Trumpism or the new right, this kind of thing that Trump has brought, which is a radical right that's willing to fight and willing to push back. J.D. Vance, there's a populist right that's come up in the United States now, and we were wondering at when we were looking at the 2016 election or 2020 election, well, what happens? What happens if Donald Trump loses? Because there was a lot of people in the GOP, from John Thune to Mitch McConnell to whoever, who would happily have put the stake in the heart of everything that that Trump had pushed for, a working class, nationalist, American first, bring back industry kind of party with traditional values, mostly. I know Trump wasn't the major guy for that, but some of them. He was on abortion. The
yes.
J.D. Vance is proof that this isn't just going away. I mean, Ohio is a bellwether state. It's a place where Trump did very well by speaking of these things. And J.D. Vance is a person who's really pushed a lot of these ideas, pushed these hard, willing to do radical things, kind of like in the Josh Hawley mode or the Blake Masters mold. So, I mean, Karl Rove can sit there with his typewriter and his stupid whiteboard just trying to figure out what exactly this means for his checkers game. But as far as a new young face and a leader for a new American right that's willing to say, no, we're not doing this. American jobs come back. Wall Street has sold out the working class. Hollywood has sold out the working class. Silicon Valley, Washington, D.C. has done it. Tons of people have gotten rich in this country while just alienating and destroying the center of it. That's a huge win.
Well, I've been actually confused, I don't know about you, by this news cycle about Trump's endorsement and the power of Trump's endorsement, because we've been through it five times. And it's like collective amnesia in the media pretending that we haven't litigated this so many times before, that Donald Trump's endorsement, he endorses all kinds of people. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
He hires off of TV. And he also hires people, like some of his close lieutenants have been people who he hired from his club. He used to work the door or something. Mm-hmm. He's got an eclectic way of hiring people, but you have to kind of reach him to get it. I think one of the reasons for it is because the Democratic Party is this week, before Roe v. Wade, released their plan for what the election was going to be, how they were going to run for re-election. And the plan was, we're going to make it all about Donald Trump. And if I was like one of the hundreds of embattled Democratic congressmen, I'd be like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the plan? Are you going to do any policy ideas? Are you going to actually have any policies that make a difference in Americans' lives? Or are we just going to run against Donald Trump again? And I think that part of this obsession with the Trump endorsement game, which I think is interesting to watch it, is them just trying to make everything about Donald Trump again.
Yeah.
Actually, it was about Ohio. It was about voters. It was about a gutted industry. It was about a Wall Street and politicians that don't care about them. But that's the message they want to run with.
COVID broke the economy, and now a recession may be coming. A Federal Reserve survey broke some bad news, dating back to the 50s whenever inflation and unemployment have hit today's levels. History suggests a recession may be near. Remember what the last recession did to your retirement? It's so hard to forget. It seems like all of the time on this show, we're looking back at the aftermath of 08. So our friends at Lear Capital shared how investing in physical gold and precious metals can be a brilliant strategy against what's coming. Smart investors are buying gold and precious metals now for two reasons. One, gold can be a great hedge during a recession. And two, the closer a recession gets, the more your gold could be worth. Don't let your retirement take a hit like 08. Talk with the team at Lear Capital about owning precious metals for your savings and retirement accounts. Right now, you'll receive up to $10,000 in free bonus coins based on the value of gold coins you purchase. Visit LearFederalist.com. That's LearFederalist.com. LearFederalist.com. You know, it was interesting. I forget who said this a couple of weeks back, that maybe because Vance and Masters, both teal-backed candidates, and very interesting sort of populist people in the populist vein, candidates in the populist vein, Masters in Arizona, are not, cleaning up in the polls, although Vance eventually won. Are they talking more to those of us in the conservative movement or on the populist right, the sort of online populist right, than they are to their voters? And I actually think that's a fair question, but Vance France then tested it and I think gave us an answer. But what's particularly interesting about this general election is Tim Ryan versus J.D. Vance. That is going to be a test of how Democrats are able to combat this new message on the right. Tim Ryan is historically somebody who wants to talk about the working class, who wants to talk like an old blue dog Democrat, but kind of struggles because he faces so much pressure from the left's cultural radical activist base to go in different directions. And so this matchup is almost an ideal experiment in the message of the new right. The fact that it's taking place in a state like Ohio with somebody like J.D. Vance and then against Tim Ryan, I think this is going to be a fascinating race.
I think that's totally right. I actually hadn't really even looked ahead to the next election yet. I hadn't really thought about it. But yeah, if someone, if people like Tim Ryan were in charge of the Democratic Party, would be recognizable.
Yeah.
I mean... When the New York Times just
Not because, by the way, he struggles just like so many other Democrats to actually push the activist base away. He hasn't done that to the extent that he'd want. Yeah.
I mean, if you look at, somebody pointed out that the incredibly feeble and impotent New York Times is 3-piece, 10,000-word, 9-reporter, money, thousands of hours hit piece to try to destroy Tucker Carlson. They broke down his like the 6 conspiracies of Tucker Carlson, and it was basically like the Democratic platform of 15 years ago. It's like jobs are being shipped overseas.
Whoa. Okay,
the ruling class in corporate America don't like you. And Tim Ryan is someone who kind of has some aspects of that and try to push us to that. It will be interesting to see. I mean, it's even if you agree with somebody, and even if they speak to the voters, how does that person still win if his entire party is against you? Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone knows that too. It's like when John Daniel Davidson and I were in Michigan, we went north of Michigan to some of the places where the Reagan Republicans came from, Macomb, I think, or county. We called the union on the way there. I was driving and he was on the phone on hold for like an hour to get hold of this union person. Be like, hey, so you guys endorse President Biden or candidate Biden? And it's like, oh yes, the union stands behind him. And I just told him, BS, let's look up a bar that's across the street from an auto plant at lunchtime and sit there and see what we see. Mm-hmm. We pulled into this bar as our first stop. I tell you what, we saw every single color of MAGA hat. Mm-hmm. You could pop from the red, the white, and the camo. And I'm looking at these guys, and we're asking them. There's not a single one of them that was voting for that. Of course, the union power structure that represented them said, oh yeah, this is what the workers want. But they weren't buying it anymore.
Right.
And I wonder if that's going to happen with Tim Ryan, where it's just like, yeah, I mean, the unions will endorse them. All these husks of what used to be working class culture in America and power will represent them. But the actual humans that made those things up, they know better than that.
Well, and to the second part of your headline, the establishment is sort of stabbing at the back of somebody like J.D. Vance. It will be interesting to see how...
the Club for Growth?
Yeah, right.
So
right?
Did millions of ads, millions of dollars in ads trying to destroy him?
Yeah.
And it's like, why? Mm-hmm. I think I know why, but
One thing to just support Mandel. It's another to spend so intensely to defeat Vance.
And Mandel's an interesting character. I personally don't like his candidacy and didn't from the very beginning, but he worked very closely with a lot of Tea Party groups and developed trust in a lot of those places. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what the Club for Growth pushes. But of course, the Club for Growth also works basically hand in hand with Jeff Rowe, the Republican kind of squishy consultant, on every one of his campaigns. So his clients go out and stump for Club for Growth. And it seems to go back and forth quite a bit. So, there's a lot of folks on the right who really are defensive of the club, but I think they really stepped in on this mm-hmm. one.
Yeah, I want to return to the history because I think it's instructive, and I actually think those fissures are what we're dealing with right now. Because you write about, as we discussed earlier, the Stan Evans essay, in the context of the Goldwater ascent, which in and of itself, actually we had a Bernie Sanders deputy campaign manager on the podcast last week who compared Bernie to Goldwater and sort of somebody who lost but dragged the party to the direction that the base wanted it to go in. I think that is completely accurate. Al Reagan
wrote a book about it called Glorious Defeat.
Yeah.
Or Glorious Disaster.
Right.
That turned out to be just and an essay in it in 1964, which I have in the New Guards.
Wow.
Which I brought it to him 50 years later and said, could you write an intro to this again? He just chuckled and said, it's good to see that I was right from time to time.
Well, and so this is why I intentionally do try to push Chris to talk about these things, because his experience with the New Guard and Young Americans for Freedom, where he's on the board now, and I actually work part time, has really given him a broader aperture than so many people who discuss these issues. And I think you have a lot of respect for the people who pushed back, because the Goldwater ascent then turned into the Reagan Revolution, which was very intentionally undercut by George H.W. Bush. And George W. Bush, the tension still exists to this day. If you talk to some of those guys, it is still very raw. But I also think the Karl Rove, not taking the L on J.D. Vance, is super reminiscent of that. And I'm curious as to how you would answer the question of where the conservative movement went from the point that Stan wrote that essay in 1961 to, pre-Trump, 2015. Why is it that the conservative movement, which was always, it's never been perfectly aligned with the Republican establishment. We saw that in the years both Bushes were in the White House. But why do you think it was, when we look back with the benefit of hindsight, maybe a little impotent?
I think there's a couple of reasons. One, and I was just rereading this essay yesterday by Russell Kirk called The Chirping Secretaries. One, I think, is the absolute poison that is injected into the national conservative movement by the libertarian movement, which, while both disliking the Soviets, injected a completely unconservative message, a very process-driven message into the heart of conservative politics, and one that often, whether it was through free trade or this program or that program, was often at odds with the actual working class voters who made up a lot of the conservative movement. It's like it's an interesting thing that kind of like distills it, but they ended up betraying each other. There was the hard hat riot during Vietnam, when all these damn hippies are going through Wall Street protesting and yelling and screaming and burning flags, and both all the construction crews down there came out and fought them, and the Wall Street guys in their suits came down and fought them too. And it was like this, but at the end of the day, they were united in their dislike of hippies and communism. But at the end of the day, the libertarian aspects of it and the free trade aspects and the corporate aspects of it really poisoned a lot of the GOP and their thinking. And these process guys, this is why it's been so wild to see Vance win and Tucker win and all these other people, because the process guys have typically been extremely good at destroying you. I mean, the Trump administration accomplished so much, despite having such backstabbing and incompetence in some aspects of it. Imagine if they had the efficiency that George H.W.'s Bush people had in what they called jokingly the Night of Long Knives, when the day H.W. was inaugurated, every single conservative Reagan appointee was fired and walked out of their offices. It was the guy who'd been vice president to Reagan for 8 years to slit the throats of every one of his people in a single day. Now, that's efficiency. That's impressive. And if those guys are pushing for the corporate mindset, the free trade mindset, and cloaking it, I mean, I know that there's some libertarian listeners who are probably going to be saying that's not libertarianism. Sure, but it's that strain, that kind of corporate strain that these guys have used to enrich themselves. And I think that's part of it. And there was a great essay that came out of Angelo Codavella, who also just passed, an old friend of Stan's, who he wrote in 2010 that everyone was getting the Tea Party wrong, that Paul Ryan was wrong, none of these guys were right, that this was a revolt against the ruling class.
Yeah.
And not just a bunch of people who are concerned about the budget and the deficit. They're concerned about the lack of representation. They're concerned about – and it was prescient, so prescient, because I was there at the Tea Party rallies at the time. I read it. I loved the essay. I thought it was right, but it was really hard to tell. Mm-hmm. Like, what is going on here? And I remember going to some dinners back then in 2010 where old Republicans would get up and say, be careful what you're letting in the door. These people are radicals. You think you can co-opt them for your fiscal conservatism, but these people are a different kind of conservative than you. Oh. I remember sitting there at a dinner thinking, like, this is wild, and seeing George Will up there saying, this is great. The Tea Party is great. I love it. The same dinner. And then within 5 years, that Tea Party had become that populist right that drove George Will insane, yeah. and broke his brain and changed the GOP and outed Paul Ryan, all these different aspects, and outed Eric Cantor. So I think
young guns,
I think that these things were the conservative movement was mismanaged and also occasionally forgot that the Republican Party is always going to be a hostage situation for the conservatives. Like, they're never a willing person. Like, you have to keep the gun on them. And people recognized this at the time. Richard Viguerie, one of the founders of the conservative movement in direct mail, Bill Rusher, the publisher of National Review, guys like this were raging against the American right for 50 years, saying this is garbage. You guys aren't fighting. You're doing the wrong thing. You're being co-opted. And they kept on getting shut down and called kooks. But fortunately, now you look at JD and you look at DeSantis, you look at Tucker, it turns out the kooks are onto something.
I think there's something good about so much of the conservative movement splintering outside of Washington, D.C., Daily Wire is in Nashville and a bunch of people are moving to Florida. Because I think when you look back on that, a reason a lot of the people in the conservative movement probably wanted to go along and get along was because it is very important to have that cash that comes from getting along, especially if you live here in Washington, D.C. And no matter how immune you are to the pressures, you stay here long enough, it's a very seductive sort of temptation. So
used to be, but now they hate us.
Right, exactly. And so I think your point about the left is right. And I'm thinking to your point about the hard hat revolution and that coalition of hard hat workers and Wall Street men fighting the hippies. It does feel like what happened, what started bubbling with Trump, right? You know, you see it in the Tea Party and Trump comes in and recognizes what the conservative movement doesn't. You have movement conservatives like at the time, Marco Rubio saying we do need to be more welcoming and liberal on immigration. It was a misreading that I think was pushed by corporate interests. And you have a conservative movement that is overly responsive to corporate interests because the left is so unresponsive to corporate interests, as we see, you know, the EPA now doing, whatever. I won't go off on that tangent, but Paul Ryan was actually talking to Matt Continetti at AEI recently about the book Continetti came on
so
this
sorry
podcast.
I missed
talking
that.
About, well, so wow. Paul Ryan was talking about how they misread the Tea Party. He was sort of lamenting. He was like, we thought all these people wanted to talk about the debt and entitlements and no. But it's interesting because, you know, what keeps the hard hat coalition together with the Wall Street coalition? It's not worth it anymore to keep the Wall Street coalition at the expense of what the hard hat coalition wants, because the hard hat coalition is not being served by this country.
I remember asking, and I think maybe I talked about this at the last podcast, so stop me if I did, but I was at an IHS conference years ago, and I was talking to a friend from Reason, who's much more libertarian than I am, and I said, why does the Republican Party defend Walmart? Mm. I mean, the Waltons may have been conservative at one point, but at this point, the Walmart lobbies for food stamps and all these different kinds of subsidies and free trade. So it's customers who used to live in factory towns that have been destroyed by Walmart's trade policies Walmart pushes for can then use government subsidized food stamps to buy cheap goods from foreign companies. And then Republicans defend them as like, well, this is a free market. And then Walmart just gives all their donations to the Democratic Party. And it's like, what are you doing? How stupid are you?
I mean, it didn't used to be that way.
It didn't used to be, but I mean, I'm a huge Reagan fan completely, and I hate how his name's being attacked, but that is the epitome of the actual term zombie Reaganism, where everything around has changed. And you haven't changed.
Right.
It's like, that's wrong. And that's not what Ronald Reagan would have done.
Right. Reagan's not operating in post-WTO America, post-NAFTA America. It's a very different time. I would say Reagan was totally, even as we're both like generally more pro-union than most people in the conservative movement, but I would say Reagan was totally right about their traffic control.
Well, yeah, you can't shut down the country.
Do you know what they were asking for? Do you know the amount of money they were asking for was insane?
I don't remember the figures.
Yeah, you look them up there. It's like,
I mean,
so
sometimes you do have to bust the union. Other times you don't. Like when Calvin Coolidge busted the Boston Police Union.
Yeah.
It's like, no, because the public safety is not a bargaining chip.
Yeah.
You're all fired.
Yeah. Bye. Okay. So anyway, all this is to say, I want to sort of close on this broader point. I actually think this is not entirely the fault of the conservative movement. This is more everyone in the fog of war, post-sexual revolution, post-tech revolution, especially post-2000, it's the fog of war. Things are changing so quickly that you don't realize how dramatic those changes are going to be when everything clears up.
And it frightens people like Brett Stevens.
Well, exactly. who, by the way, oh my God, his column this week on Roe was...
That's what I kicked off my piece with. It's just him saying, this is not conservative.
It's radical.
Well, yeah. And I say, then let's be radical.
Yeah. If the definition of radical is opposing murder, let's do it.
Let's be clear, baby murder.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, sometimes people need to get murdered.
Oh, my God. Yeah, adults. Chris is from Boston. I think the reason I ended up in journalism is that I'm just so skeptical of absolutely everything. It's like a reflex. And so when the good folks over at MyPillow offered to send some towels my way, I was immediately skeptical. I thought, there's so much hype here. Can they live up to it? Nothing beats the feel of a luxurious towel when you step out of the shower. And I'm telling you, this is not scripted right here. These really work. They're very, very absorbent. I got them in a nice blue color, so you can also wrap yourself in nothing but the best with the MyPillow towel set. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they're scratchy and just don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch, but without that lotiony feel. Plus, with a 60-day money-back guarantee, you can try them for yourself and return them if you're not fully satisfied. Made with cotton grown here in the U.S. and available in a variety of colors, each towel set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and a washcloth two-pack. So for a limited time, get the MyPillow six-piece towel set regularly $109.99 for only $39.99 with promo code Federalist. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. You'll also find deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow Giza dream sheets, and so much more. Get your six-piece MyPillow towel set for only $39.99 today at MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist today. But the broader point, I think, is it's not so much the fault of the institutional conservative movement to the extent that it's operating in this environment where people did not realize, how quickly the world was changing with the sexual revolution, with technological revolution, and didn't realize that we were going to be at a place in 2022 where, you know, teachers are actually being supported by the left for talking about how they're pansexual to middle school students and instructing middle school students to explore their gender identity. I don't think anybody realized that giving these inches over and over again would lead to, you know, the 100 miles.
I think some people did, but like people like Pat Buchanan.
Yeah,
and people like Stan Evans.
No, you're right. You're right. But I also am saying
the Republican Party didn't. And as Jeff Ingersoll, the editor in chief of the Daily Caller, said to me this morning, he's like, people don't realize it's not just libs of TikTok. You walk into Harvard and you walk into the information services that they set up, and it's an army of nose ringed, pink haired weirdos who are coming up with new ideas of how to censor you under the guise of one of the great old institutions, one of the oldest colleges in the United States. There's this as an army, and you can't just snip around the edges, which I like that people are doing, but you can't just say like CRT can't be taught in our schools. You need to do what like J.D. Vance is talking about. Go into the guts of the university system. Yep. You need to pull away the student loans. You need to take their money from them. Our ideas can no longer be laundered through our enemies' camps. And that's the kind of thinking that Republicans need to do. At this point, they're wrong. Brett Stevens is wrong. Mitch McConnell's and John Thune are wrong. There's no tinkering around the edges. We're fighting like an army. The edges, this thing is destroying us. We need to go at its core.
No, and I think you're right about Viguerie and Stan and Pat Buchanan, people who were, you know, influential in the conservative movement and were persuasive. Phyllis Schlafly, great example as well.
She fought like a left-wing radical. Oh. She went out there with the signs and she fought.
But in some ways, she was so different. I remember one of my formative experiences back in 2012, at GW. We brought Phyllis Schlafly to campus with our YAF chapter, and she was, oh gosh, I want to say she was 89 at the time, and still.
I met her around then through YAF too.
Yeah, she was still as, you know, sharp as you can imagine, and she was obviously a brilliant woman, but she we had a pretty, you know, good group of students, but we got protested so hard by the feminist and gay groups on campus. It was really bitter, man, and nasty.
I hope that when I'm 89, like, the feminists and gay groups still want to protest me.
Well, so
it's good to be remembered.
Well, what they did, and this was where the stark contrast came in, is they lined the walls of a narrow hallway going into the event space.
I remember this.
To sort of physically intimidate an 89-year-old woman with these signs that they were putting extremely close to her face and screaming extremely close to her face, like really in her personal space.
Shameful, but she was used to it.
Totally used to it. And I was the one that was walking her through this crowd. And at that moment, I was just like, these people are graduating.
These are your enemies. Treat them as such.
These people are graduating into the so-called real world, and they sure as hell aren't going to be shaped by it. They're going to shape that world. And so Phyllis Schlafly got a walkout protest at that event. Of course, this has happened to her many, many times over the course of her career. She's had things thrown at her, et cetera, death threats. You know, you can go on down the line. But she smiled and was polite, and all of her retorts were so clever that, you know, she didn't need to so-called stoop to their level. She was just principled, and that's all anybody's asking. You know, your principle should be principled and unafraid. And so your principle in Disney is what's at stake. And if your principle is being complicit in their queer agenda for children, that's not a great principle. And so I guess I also don't. I'm just saying, in the past several decades, when Pat Buchanan's out there and people are calling him a kook, I understand why that was happening, because the fog of war blinded people to how radically the country was changing. Technology has been treated as progressive, which is sort of synonymous with good in the context of tech. And so as we take all of these steps, you know, allegedly forward, we're not realizing that they're taking us to a very anti-human and dangerous place. And I actually understand why people didn't have that perspective through the years, although some did. And it's a damn shame that it took us so long to figure it out.
Just wake up.
Yeah.
Those guys were prophets, and they were right. And it's here right now. And we're at a place where America needs radicals.
Christopher Bedford, radical tech executive, world traveler. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Of course. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray. In the vase that you bore today.